It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we have our weekly political check-in with 538's Harry Enten.
First, Americans are no strangers to debates over the influence of money or big business in politics. Calls for campaign finance reform were a rallying cry in Bernie Sanders' campaign. Hillary Clinton has been criticized for connections to Wall Street, and Donald Trump has touted his political influence as a billionaire and political donor.
Today, Wisconsin may be ground zero in the debate over the influence of money in politics. An expose that was published in The Guardian today features leaked court documents from Wisconsin's John Doe investigations, which probed into whether there were campaign finance violations by Governor Walker's recall election campaign in 2012.
The leaked documents include copies of checks and emails between wealthy donors and people connected to the Walker campaign. The report is posted on Central Time's Facebook page. Ed Pilkington joins us now. He's the chief reporter for The Guardian U.S. who wrote the expose on the leaked documents. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be with you.
Well, your story is called Because Scott Walker Asked. Where does that title come from?
It's from a handwritten note in the subject line of a check written by one of the corporate donors that we found among these leaked documents. And what's interesting about it was that the check, though it said, because Scott Walker asked, was actually written to Wisconsin Club for Growth, which is a third-party outside group. It's a tax-exempt, non-partisan, non-political organization. And yet we found a pattern in which Scott Walker was asking for money to help in his own recall election in 2012 and to help fellow Republican senators in 2011 go through similar recall elections. They asked for money, and then the money was always passed through outside groups, most commonly Wisconsin Club for Growth.
And Scott Walker, at the time your story picks up, is facing a recall election, as you just alluded to, and is in need of donors to help him beat back that challenge. And based on what you saw, how does his team direct him to look for that financial support?
Well, his fundraiser, shortly before the petition was launched to put him through a recall election, sent him a note in which it was quite clear she was briefing him about what he needed to do to raise enough money to win the recall. And it kind of goes to the heart of what these leaked documents reveal, I think. She writes, "Corporations, go heavy after them to give. Take Coke's money." That's a reference to the Koch brothers, the multi-billionaire coal and oil tycoons. She says, "Get on a plane to Vegas and sit down with Sheldon Adelson, who is another billionaire casino owner. Ask for $1 million now." And that's sort of the tone that comes out of these documents. There's a sense that a senior politician such as Scott Walker and his personal campaign committee has the desire to go out there, approach billionaires right across the nation. He goes down to Texas several times. He goes across to New York often and sits down with very wealthy individuals and major corporations and asks them for money to fight a local election in Wisconsin. And I think that goes to the heart of the question here. Is it illegal? Very probably it isn't illegal. But is it in the spirit of electoral health in America that local elections such as this, these recall elections, were being waged with many millions of dollars of corporate money?
And one news story in your reporting that's picking up steam, a donor closer to home, is a look at donations made by Harold Simmons of NL Industries and also laws passed by Republican-led legislature in Wisconsin limiting the liability of the lead paint manufacturers. And I want to pick up that aspect first. Where does Harold Simmons come into the picture?
Well, again, this is another part of the pattern I've been describing. Harold Simmons was a Texas-based billionaire industrialist who owned lots of important companies, one of them being NL Industries. Historically, that was National Lead Industries, which gave an indication of what it did. It was one of the major producers of lead in the country. And until 1978, when it was banned, NL Industries was a major producer of lead paint. Now, if you look in cities like Milwaukee, particularly poor areas of cities like Milwaukee, where there are a lot of rundown houses, There's a very high incidence of lead paint poisoning. It's not dissimilar to what's been happening in Flint, Michigan with the water. In fact, it's at levels often considerably worse, that kids in particular have been vulnerable to high levels of lead poisoning from lead paint, which just crumbles off these old walls in their old houses. And what we see from the documents are two things. One, we see a tranche of three different checks amounting to $750,000 arriving from NL Industries, again to Wisconsin Club for Growth. And this is shortly after there is evidence in the documents that Scott Walker's campaign committee was interested in seeking Harold Simmons's help. He was a major funder of right-wing causes until he died in 2013. In a similar time frame, the Wisconsin Republican-controlled legislature, with Governor Walker's sign-off, made several attempts to make it much more difficult for victims of lead paint poisoning in Wisconsin to sue any lead paint producer, including NL Industries, for compensation for the damage that they had gone through as a result of lead poisoning. And as we know, and we've seen it in Flint, Michigan, lead poisoning can really do substantial harm to the development of kids when they take in the toxin.
We're talking with Ed Pilkington right now about his story looking at leaked documents from Wisconsin's John Doe probe. And his story's up on the Central Time Facebook page. It's called Because Scott Walker Asked. And with that story about the legislation, is there any trail there between the two? Are these two not connected? You just see them as beginning to develop in a parallel fashion?
That pattern you can see happening time and time again. And you know, it's common enough, I think, to raise questions about intent. Now, are we saying that there was quid pro quo, i.e. cash for favors, corruption happening in this or other cases? We're not saying that. There isn't the firm evidence in the documents that suggest it definitely was intentional and it happened in that way. But as we point out in the article, the U.S. Supreme Court has made clear many, many times in rulings going back decades that it's not just real corruption that needs to be prevented through campaign finance laws. Even the appearance of potential corruption needs to be avoided, because if people suspect that their politicians may be passing new laws out of favoritism for people who are backing them with money for their elections, that could be seriously damaging to the health of a democracy, to faith in democracy. So even the appearance of possible quid pro quo should be avoided, and the U.S. Supreme Court has made that very, very clear. And the way to avoid it, they say, is to keep separate the corporate money that is coming into elections from the candidate themselves. And big questions are raised, I think, in the documents that we have posted today and that we received as a leak from the John Doe investigation about whether that coordination was breached, and if so, how serious was that breach.
Now, you reached out to the Wisconsin Club for Growth. This is the organization that apparently received a lot of the donations that you write about. What did they say?
They have made clear over time that they feel that there was no wrongdoing done here by them or anyone else. They've also made the point that the John Doe investigation was shut down by the Wisconsin courts. And that's a similar point that Scott Walker's office, his campaign office, made to us, that in their case, in the statement they gave to us, no wrongdoing was done, and the investigation was shut down by several different courts in Wisconsin. It has to be said that the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the nation, is currently considering a petition from the prosecutors. It's on their desk at the moment. The eight justices are currently looking at it, and they've indicated that by the end of this month they will announce whether or not they will take the petition and actually review the decision of the Wisconsin courts to shut down the investigation. So this story is not yet over, and we haven't yet had the end of the story in terms of legal judgment on it.
Now, to elaborate a little on the response from Scott Walker's campaign, Joe Fadness has said, as you mentioned, several courts shut down the baseless investigation on multiple occasions, and there is absolutely no evidence of any wrongdoing. What do you make of that response?
Well, It is true that the courts in Wisconsin have shut it down, and that last year the Wisconsin Supreme Court confirmed that, and they said the John Doe investigation was firmly at an end. They gave a very strongly worded ruling to that effect. And yet, when we came to look at the documents, it became clear to us that there was a story behind even that story, and that's something, again, that emerges from these documents. You go layer upon layer of complexity here, and layer upon layer of questions being asked about the corporate influence in elections, because you find that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has a 4-3 majority, conservative to liberal, balance on it, and that a few years ago, in fact, exactly the same time that the Republican senators were facing recall in 2011, one of those Supreme Court justices, David Prosser, was facing his own re-election, and he was funded to the tune of several million dollars by exactly the same groups and outside lobbying groups that the John Doe investigation had been probing, and exactly the same investigation that he then went on to join the ruling that shut it down, which, you know, I think in many people's minds would raise the question of conflict of interest. That was put to him at the time last year, and he refused to recuse himself from that decision. We talked to him, and he said to us that he thought sufficient time had passed between 2011 and 2015 to fade any potential conflict of interest, and he felt there was no need to accuse himself. Though, again, I think it leaves question marks about, you know, checks and balances. Are there sufficient checks and balances going on here that the judiciary can make decisions that are fully independent? And you know, this goes to the heart of the issue here. Is the role of all this money coming in, the politicians and even judges need for it in order to keep their jobs, is that starting to distort the electoral and the political process in America?
And that's how you end your piece. I mean, you get pretty deep into the thicket of campaign finance, law, and ethics here. But you end by wanting to tell people why you think this story matters. And just briefly, how would you summarize that argument?
Well, yes. And, you know, I should say we posted 1,500 pages of documents which are under seal to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And at one point, the court actually ordered those documents destroyed. So we didn't lightly go into this. We knew that we were doing something that was quite controversial, that many people in Wisconsin and elsewhere may disapprove of. But we asked ourselves a serious question. What is the public interest in these documents? And I think it's quite simple to say, which is this. Can there be any subject more worthy of being in the public interest than the health of the American democracy? And it boils down to that. Are people being elected on the power of their ideas and on the power of their leadership, or are they being elected because they have the most corporate money in their pockets? And as Donald Trump himself has said on the campaign trail several times, boasting about his own influence over politicians, he says he goes around, he buys politicians, he pays them money, and once he's paid the money, they'll do anything for him. Now, if the Republican presidential nominee, who is potentially a few months away from the White House, says things like that, then I think we all have reason to be concerned.
Ed, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That was Ed Pilkington. He's the chief reporter for The Guardian U.S., joining us to talk about an expose he wrote on leaked court documents in Wisconsin's John Doe investigations.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll take a look at the status of black bears in Wisconsin in the midst of bear hunting season.
Right now, we get our latest check-in on what's happening on the campaign trail and in national politics.
Republican nominee Donald Trump has been closing in on Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton in the polls in recent weeks, but those numbers may be plateauing.
And Clinton is having a difficult time reaching millennial voters, and President Obama is hitting the campaign trail to make a case for the former Secretary of State.
I am really into electing Hillary Clinton. Like, I this is not me going through the motions here. I really, really, really want to elect Hillary Clinton.
Joining us now, as he does most Wednesdays, to talk national politics is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, give us the latest. That post-convention bounce for Hillary Clinton has been slipping. Where are we now in polling?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where it's a day by day, right? So it seemed like it was slipping for a few weeks. Then earlier this week or over the weekend, it seemed like Clinton's lead had kind of bottomed out at about 3 percentage points nationwide, or 3 to 4 percentage points nationwide. But now we're seeing some polls again that suggest that, in fact, the race may be getting tighter. We still have Clinton at about a two-thirds chance of winning this election, but that's far down from what the poll suggested after the conventions, when she was about a 90% chance of winning.
Electoral college-wise, since we vote state by state, that number's been tightening, too, as far as your best predictions based on state polling.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, what we know is that state polling, when you aggregate it together, also gives us a more accurate picture of what's going on nationally. So if you were to look at the national polls themselves, it might suggest an even tighter race than that 3 or 4 point race. But when you aggregate those state polls, it suggests more like 3 or 4. But no doubt that the state polls are tightening. We now saw two polls out today from the state of Ohio, which have Donald Trump ahead. And these are not polls by crummy organizations. They're by CNN, ORC, and the Bloomberg Selzer poll, which are pretty good. CNN also showed Clinton behind in the state of Florida. But I should point out there is a map, and in fact, Clinton doesn't need either Florida or Ohio to win this election. So right now, even though those polls are tightening and Trump's moving ahead, we still have Clinton as the favorite to win the Electoral College.
Well, these polls are just coming out. We heard the news over the weekend of Hillary Clinton's pneumonia, it turned out. And also, she got into some trouble over this statement. Here's a listen.
To just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. And unfortunately, there are people like that. And he has lifted them up.
So a lot of media response to that, Trump campaign response to that. Are we seeing those two factors, the illness maybe and this statement starting to show up in the polls yet, or is it too soon, Harry?
It's a little bit too soon. What we can say, there's some conflicting signs. For instance, there's the USC tracking poll with the LA Times, and that does show, even though that poll tends to be more favorable for Trump, we do see trend lines in his direction, which is what we really be watching. The trend line is moving towards him. But at the same time, the Gallup tracking poll nationwide, which doesn't look at the horse race but looks at the candidate favorability ratings, in fact shows Clinton with a slight uptick since this weekend, while Trump has basically stayed level. So it's a little too soon to exactly tell what's the cause of these tightening numbers and whether or not the illness and this basket of deplorable line actually is what's causing the race to tighten.
So the Trump campaign is running with the basket of deplorables line. Here's a listen to a Trump campaign ad.
Hillary Clinton called tens of millions of Americans deplorable.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables. The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
People like you, you, and you, deplorable. You know what's deplorable? Hillary Clinton viciously demonizing hardworking people like you.
So trying to make an issue of it there. Harry, in a chat at 538.com, your colleagues tried to, as best you could, figure out how many of Donald Trump supporters fit into those categories of exhibiting racism or sexism, homophobia, etc. Hard thing to measure was part of the conclusion, but what kind of things were you trying to look at?
Well, we were, you know, looking at different things, such as would you be willing to vote for a candidate who matches this description for president? Would you feel comfortable living in a community that was biracial or, you know, a mixture of African Americans and white people? And different measures lead you to different things. So if you look at one measure, for instance, it might only lead you to believe that 10% of Republicans are racist. And if you look at another measure, perhaps it's closer to 50 to 60%. But the overall conclusion from that chat was that if you asked Americans, would you be willing to vote for a Muslim president? A majority of Republicans said that they would not. And based on that, if you're, you know, very tying it to be a very technical thing, it would be fair to say that a majority of Republicans exhibit some sort of bigoted behavior. But again, it really does depend on the definition, and I'm sure that Trump fans would argue very much so with that finding.
Now, you also wrote this week about millennial voters. They loved Barack Obama more so than most candidates, most Democratic candidates, I think, was one conclusion. That isn't necessarily translating into love for Hillary Clinton.
Exactly. So what we basically did was I got this great data from SurveyMonkey, which allowed us really to drill down into younger voters, millennials, both the older and the younger millennials. And what we found was specifically among those who are 18 to 24-year-olds, Barack Obama is more popular with them than in any other part of the electorate, yet Clinton's margin with them is only about 13 percentage points, which is below how well she's doing with older millennials, and it's far worse than Barack Obama did 4 years ago among 18 to 24-year-olds when he carried that vote, if you believe certain data, by about 30 percentage points. So there's clearly something going on there, and right now what it is these younger millennials aren't going for Trump, but they are saying that they're going to vote for a third party. It's going to be interesting to see as this election gets closer and if the polls tighten whether or not those younger millennials decide, you know what, I'm afraid of wasting my vote. I don't want to put Trump in the White House and move towards Clinton.
Hillary Clinton off the campaign trail for a couple days now with the pneumonia, but she has this parade of proxies. We mentioned Barack Obama on the trail already, former President Clinton, Joe Biden, others. Are they going to be enough to carry the campaigning momentum for her until she's back on her feet?
I mean, who's really to say? What we know is Barack Obama and Joe Biden and Bill Clinton are all more popular than Hillary Clinton is. I would argue, though, that the longer Clinton is off of the campaign trail and the more doubt that is sown about her fitness, her health, that is, to be president, I would argue that's a bad thing. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure how much of a difference being off the trail for 2 or 3 days really makes versus 4 or 5. If she's off for a more extended period than that, then that might lead to some trouble because I think the whispers might become much louder about her health issues.
And briefly, Harry, are we looking at the debates as maybe the best next big pivot point?
Hey, you know what? This year, the debates could very well make the difference when you have a very tight race. Could be something like 1980 or even something like 1960 when Kennedy won those debates over Richard Nixon.
Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Harry Enten. He is a senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us weekly to give us the latest in the polls and in the national political campaign.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about black bears in Wisconsin and what to expect from this year's hunting season. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll learn about efforts to expand broadband in the state and why our guest says it's crucial for rural Wisconsin.
First, bear hunting season is underway here in Wisconsin, and today is the first day of the season that hunters are allowed to use dogs to pursue bears. There are some changes in store for this year's hunt, including a new law in place that aims to crack down on hunter harassment.
Even with that law in place, members of one animal protection group say they're planning to monitor and document bear hunting activity, which could test the limits of the new legislation.
Here with us now to talk more about bears and bear hunting in Wisconsin, we have David Drake with us. He's professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. He's also a wildlife specialist for UW Extension. David, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
Let's start with Black Bear 101 here in Wisconsin. Okay. What do we know about how big the population is here in the state?
Well, the population seems to be growing, increasing in numbers. Now I think the DNR has completed a second, what's called a mark recapture study to try to estimate the population size of bears. And for a long time, I think the DNR thought maybe the bear population was around 10,000, 13,000, something like that. And now they are estimating the bear population is probably closer to 29,000.
Does that mean the bear population has grown or that we've gotten better at counting them?
It's most likely probably a little bit of both, but most likely that the population has actually grown. And one of the reasons we think that is that we see that the bears are expanding from their primary range, which is the northern third of Wisconsin. Bears are primarily a forest-associated species, or they like forest land. And so the northern third of the state is the primary bear range, but now bears are seen pretty commonly throughout the state of Wisconsin, you know, even far into the southern parts of Wisconsin. And I think the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the agency responsible for managing bears, that is, I think maybe two or three southeasternmost counties in Wisconsin are about the only counties that have not had regular sightings of bears in them lately.
What accounts for the growth in numbers and the widening range?
Well, I think certainly everything's driven kind of by habitat, and so is the amount of food that's on the landscape, the amount of shelter and other available resources for bears. And so typically the better habitat you have, then you've got better reproductive success, and bear populations can grow for that. The other issue is in Wisconsin here, if you're a bear hunter, there's a lottery system. It's called a lottery system to draw a bear tag to legally harvest a bear. And depending on what zone you're in, there's four different bear hunting zones in the state of Wisconsin. Depending on what zone you're in, it may take you up to 9 years of being in that lottery before you're actually able to draw a tag. And so some people think that perhaps there's not as much harvest pressure being put on the bear population as there could be, and that also is not the harvest pressure is not limiting the amount of growth within the statewide bear population.
I know with wolves there's an ongoing argument debate over what the right number to aim for is. Do we have a sense, has somebody said this is about how many black bears we want in Wisconsin's population?
Not necessarily saying, you know, we want exactly 31,219 bears and no more, no less. It really is a balancing act. And again, it's the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is the state agency responsible for managing the bear population and regulates the bear harvest. And so every year they have a population model that they input a bunch of variables into, and they get a sense about how large that population is annually. And then it's a balancing act between providing recreational opportunities such as legal harvesting of bears, recreationally viewing bears, things of that nature. Bears can do a decent amount of destruction on the landscape. So they're a pretty good damager of agricultural crops like fruit nurseries and corn crops and things like that. You know, certainly bears break into homes and cabins and will take food out of the cupboard and things of that nature. So the DNR is trying to balance all of these competing interests between holding down nuisance-causing bears and reducing the amount of nuisance-causing bears, but as well as providing a variety of opportunities for Wisconsin residents to enjoy bears.
And the DNR also offers advice on how to avoid bears becoming a nuisance for you. They have a lot of advice for homeowners, campers, people like that who might have undesirable interactions with bears. What should we humans be doing and not doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is very proactive, along with a federal agency called the United States Department of Agriculture and Wildlife Services. And every state has a wildlife services office and group of biologists. And so between the Wildlife Services, USDA Wildlife Services, they are actually the ones who help the DNR to manage the nuisance bears or the bears causing problems. So between the DNR and Wildlife Services, they're both very, very proactive about trying to educate the public, like you said, about what to do and what not to do.
So what do you have some tips you can share from their recommendations off the top of your head?
Yeah, you know, the biggest one is not to feed the bears. Obviously, if you start
on purpose or accidentally.
Yeah, intentionally or unintentionally, exactly. And now we're kind of in a gray area here because there is intentional feeding of bears to bait bears for hunting purposes. So you can legally bait bears during a certain time of the year in order to increase your chance of harvesting a bear.
As a licensed hunter.
As a licensed hunter, exactly. Other than that, you should not intentionally be feeding bears. But a lot of people hang bird feeders, for example, because they want to attract the birds to their yard to view the birds and enjoy the birds. Bears love birdseed, for example, so they will come to that birdseed. If you've got a compost pile in your backyard, bears may be attracted to that. Certainly, you know, I think we all grew up with Yogi Bear and the trash dump at Yellowstone Park, and so bears are, you know, have affinity for trash and things of that nature. So there's a lot of unintended feeding going on the landscape. And as you feed bears, then not only do you attract them to that food source, but you attract them repeatedly. And then as bears come in contact with human beings and nothing bad happens to that bear, they start to lose their fear of us or become habituated to us. And that's where the problems really start to become exaggerated, because now all of a sudden the bears are bolder. They don't run away when they see us. Perhaps they start attacking livestock, or they start breaking into cabins or getting into trouble, so to speak.
Talking to David Drake from UW-Madison and UW-Extension, looking at Wisconsin's bear population as black bear hunting season is underway. David, been saying black bears. Do we have other kinds of bears in Wisconsin?
No, we only have black bears, but there are certainly in other parts of the United States, there's polar bears and there's grizzly bears as well, but only black bears in Wisconsin.
Now let's talk about the role of the hunting season in bear management efforts. Deer we talk about all the time here. Controversy over the wolf hunt. Can you talk a little bit about the role of black bear hunting season?
Yeah, and not just for black bear hunting, but anytime you have a game species, and a game species is defined as a species that's able to be legally harvested and sustainable too. So that's not gonna decimate or cause a decline in that population's numbers. So legal harvest is really the primary effective tool that's used by wildlife managers to try to maintain wildlife populations at what's called management goal. And it really is a very effective management tool. So if you don't use some kind of a effective limitation for that population growth, you're going to have large increases in the population, and then you're going to see consequential negative impacts from that large increase in the population. So, for example, you're going to have more depredation to agricultural crops or to landscaping or whatever the case might be. So primarily with bears, the primary form of mortality is hunting, but it also sometimes is a vehicular collision where the bears collide with vehicles. And you know, a male bear might be as much as 350 pounds, but we've had bears in Wisconsin shot that were 600 and 700 pounds, and that's a big animal to be colliding with a vehicle. And so now all of a sudden you're not only putting the bear's life at danger, but you're putting people's lives in danger who are driving on those roadways that bears are crossing. And I'm not sure that, you know, I guess I would argue that it's probably a more humane death for a bear to be harvested with a bow or a gun than it is to get hit by a car. That's just my opinion. So somehow you've got to manage that population growth, and the best way to do it is through hunting.
What's the black bear's role in Wisconsin's ecosystem?
Well, certainly, you know, they're a omnivore, so they eat a lot of different food sources. They'll certainly eat other animals, but they also eat a lot of berries and things like that. So they are able to sometimes maintain different populations of pest species, for example. You know, they're not feeding on small mice necessarily, but they can certainly try to maintain some of the prey species that they are eating. So that's a good one. As they wander across the landscape, a lot of times we look at them as kind of a keystone species. So if bear, because they can occupy such a large range, if bears are doing okay, then we assume that that the habitat that is supporting the bears is doing okay, and all the other associated species within that habitat probably are doing okay as well. So there's a couple of different ecological purposes for them. And then obviously, from a human standpoint, you know, there's just a tremendous amount of people that enjoy seeing bears, recreating, you know, as bear, with bear being the primary purpose of that recreation. And they certainly bring a lot of money into the economy.
We're talking right now about black bears in Wisconsin as the bear hunting season continues to get underway. We have David Drake with us, professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Will you be taking part in this season's bear hunt? Have you had any interaction with bears on your land or maybe in your town? And what questions do you have about black bears in Wisconsin? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a few moments here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about black bears in Wisconsin, and today is the first day of the season where hunters can use dogs to pursue bears, and we're taking stock of the bear population and looking at changes to this year's hunt, including a new anti-harassment law for hunters.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you taking part in the bear hunt this year? Do you think it's important that the animals be hunted, or do you have concerns about it? Do you have questions about black bears here in Wisconsin? Wisconsin. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Melanie is with us in Star Prairie. Melanie, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
We sure can.
Yeah, I'm calling about the bear baiting. You briefly mentioned it, but bear baiting goes on in Wisconsin for, to my knowledge, 141 days. Versus Minnesota, which is only 14 days. It's unlimited. It's 10 gallons a day, I believe, but it's unlimited baiting. And in 2014, they had recorded via the Bear Hunter Survey over 4.6 million gallons of bear bait that was put down. And I understand that that's probably increasing because applications and licenses are going up. And so since that, we only have habitat for 11,500 bears in the state, I'm just wondering that bear baiting has to be the reason why we have 29,000 bears in the state, and the bear baiting creates problems for wolves as well. And so I'm just wondering, do you foresee this bear baiting changing in Wisconsin?
Melanie, thanks for the call. David, so does she have that right? We're not just baiting when we're hunting. We're baiting to get them coming to a place over a period of time well outside of the hunting season.
Yeah, and that's true. Let me just correct maybe or add some clarity. One thing Melanie said is the state has got more habitat and more room than just for 11,500 bears. I mean, literally the entire state at this point, because we've got so much forested habitat across the state, literally the entire state could be considered bear habitat if we wanted to allow bears to come this far south. One of the reasons there's some concern about them coming into the southern part of the state is because that's obviously where the concentration of the human population is, and the more bears and humans mix, the more chances we're going to have some kind of negative consequence occurring from that interaction. So I just want to clarify that. So you can bait. You can start baiting in Wisconsin on April 15th. And you can bait through the end of the bear season. So bear season typically starts the first Wednesday after Labor Day. So this year it starts September 7th, and it runs until October 11th. So you can bait from April 15th to October 11th this year. And you can put out up to 10 pounds of bait at one time. And there's some restrictions on where you can bait and things of that nature. The other thing is the bait has to be completely contained in a container or stuck into a hollow of a log or something like that. So primarily deer can't get to the bait because there's issues with baiting deer, concentrating deer, and spreading diseases like chronic wasting disease. So there are consequences of this, and there's some very good thought that's been put into baiting restrictions and when you can bait, where you can bait, how much you can bait, and things like that. And certainly there are differences across the states where different states have different bear hunting regulations. One of the reasons that baiting is allowed in Wisconsin and the use of dogs is allowed in Wisconsin in three of the four zones is because those are both very, very effective tools to try to increase the harvest of bears. And if you've got a growing bear population, obviously from a management standpoint, you want to try to limit that population growth to the extent you can and harvest as many potential bears as would be allowed to be harvested that year. And so baiting is a tool that allows hunters to do that.
Melanie, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Gary on the line in Madison. Gary, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to say about the 4.5 million gallons of bait, too. That's one way to get bears acclimated to humans. It just doesn't seem right. But what really angers me is the fact that the state Republican government recently decided to put $0 into state parks, and yet they pay up to $2,500 per hound to these so-called hunters for any hounds that get attacked by wolves. Well, the hunters send the dogs out into wolf territory. It's like they're asking for it. And then the hounds chase the bears up into a tree, and the so-called hunter can shoot them down like fish in a barrel. It's just absurd. I don't get it.
Gary, thanks for the call. That's one of the controversies over the use of dogs in bear hunting is that dogs run afoul of wolves, get killed. People like Gary worried about the state compensating hunters in those instances. Can you talk a little more about the controversy over hounds in the bear hunting?
Yeah, sure will. And Gary, they don't pay me enough to comment on whether there's Republicans or Democrats responsible for anything in the state, so I'm going to leave the politics out of this per se. But certainly there's controversy about running dogs. I understand that. And the controversy comes from dogs getting killed while they're training the dogs to hunt and pursue bear, getting killed by wolves. There's controversy involved with the fact that people don't necessarily think it's a fair chase doctrine if you're using dogs and chasing bears and then certainly chasing them into trees and shooting the bear out of the tree. I understand that there's, you know, not everybody agrees with all of that. But again, you know, the dogs are a useful tool, again, if you want to try to increase your chance of harvesting a bear. And if you look at the state statistics here in Wisconsin, the vast majority of bears get shot over bait, not necessarily with the use of dogs. And so certainly I think in the last couple of years, maybe, you know, 15 or so percent of the bears have been shot only using dogs, whereas maybe 65% of the bears or a greater percentage of that have been shot over bait. So bait is probably a little bit more useful of a tool. The other thing about up north, where most of the baiting takes place, is that in the northern part of Wisconsin, you know, we don't have nearly the density of human population we have. So they're not interacting with humans as much up in the northern part of the state as they would be if somebody was baiting down in the southern part of the state.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to David Drake about black bears in Wisconsin in the midst of black bear hunting season here in the state. So it sounds like, David, if we're talking about this from a conservation and management standpoint, not so worried about whether it's sporting or not. You're worried about hitting the harvest targets.
Well, yes, but I think certainly if you're an ethical hunter and you've grown up in that culture, that, you know, there is the issue about what's called the North American wildlife model of conservation. So you do want it to be fair chase doctrine, and you do want to be an ethical hunter and things of that nature. But certainly there is that balance, again, where you've got a growing or seemingly growing bear population right now, and there is a need to be efficient and effective in harvesting bears to try to limit that population growth.
Do we have a sense of how the hunt is going so far, not quite a week yet, without dogs?
I do not have a sense, although I have a student in my class this semester who went up to help his cousin harvest a bear, and they did not get one this past week. So, but I don't know. I don't know so far how the first week of the season has been playing out.
And we've touched briefly on an issue that I know you're not following super closely, but there's the new-ish law on hunter harassment in Wisconsin limiting mainly protesters' ability to interact with hunters, interfere with them, video them as part of it. Have we had difficult interactions like that in the past in Wisconsin or elsewhere in the country?
I'm not sure about it in Wisconsin. I know in other parts of the country, especially as you move out toward the East Coast, that you know, hunting is not a very popular activity. And if you look at the statistics across the country, the number of people participating in hunting activities is dropping, you know, every year. And so it's a minority of our population, both in the state but also nationally, that is hunting. And so, you know, and again, I think this is part of the larger picture. As a public or as a society, we are getting further and further removed from the outdoor world. We're spending more time, you know, inside. And so that issue about hunting is a little bit more foreign to I think, generations recently than it has been to maybe our grandparents' generation or something like that, where hunting was a little bit more of a, you know, social and more popular common activity. So I again, as with, you know, baiting and using bear dogs and things like that, I certainly know that not everybody is in favor of hunting, but it is a legal activity. And as long as you're hunting legally and ethically, there is no reason that you should be harassed doing something that is a legal activity.
As we wrap up, David, let's look big picture at the black bear in Wisconsin. When we think of large mammals, deer have the threat of chronic wasting disease. Wolves, we have the question, how many wolves is the right amount of wolves? How about black bears? You mentioned habitat has been in their favor lately. It sounds like any other long-term concerns or hopeful signs for the black bear in the state?
Certainly the population seems to be growing or has been growing recently, and it probably is going to continue to grow a little bit like that. And so I think we're going to have a robust black bear population in the state for years to come, and especially if the DNR continues to manage the population the way that they are.
And that means, I presume, we will have a black bear hunting season as we do now for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I would be very, very surprised if we ever lose a black bear hunting season in the state of Wisconsin in the foreseeable future.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to David Drake. He's professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. He's also a wildlife specialist for UW Extension. He joined us to talk about black bears here in Wisconsin. A black bear hunting season is underway, has been since last weekend, I think it was. Today starts starts the time when hunters can use dogs as part of the hunt. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences hunting bear or your thoughts on how we hunt for bears here in Wisconsin. You can do that over at the Central Time Facebook page. Just send us a message, share your thoughts or experiences there, or share them very briefly on Twitter at Central Time WPR. Again, you can share your thoughts on that or any other issue we talk about here on Central Time on our social media presences, Central Time Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Driverless cars may be the wave of the future, and they're making one small step closer to reality today in Pittsburgh.
The ride-sharing company Uber is rolling out a trial service with self-piloting cars. Uber users in a selected area can opt in if they want to. But the cars that show up will not be eerily empty. A company driver will be in the driver's seat to take over driving duties if the robo-car goes wrong somehow.
There's also something strange about someone who's sitting there in the car with you, but not driving.
At the wheel.
Someone that you don't know.
Yeah, that's maybe more disturbing than no one in the seat at all. Like somebody in there, why aren't they doing anything?
It's all disturbing. I don't know. I enjoy driving personally. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I would want this driverless car unless I was especially tired. I wanted to take a nap. I don't know. It remains to be seen. Would you want to be in one of these cars?
There are times when I don't even feel comfortable trusting cruise control, honestly. That seems like giving the machines too much power over our lives. On the other hand, the driverless cars will not fiddle around with a radio dial, check their text messages, put on makeup, and eat a burger all at the same time while they drive. So maybe an upside, but I think I'm probably like a lot of people and you, it's going to take some psychological cultural changes.
Not ready yet. What if they become sentient?
What indeed? Well, we'll answer these haunting questions here on Central Time.